Today is Sunday. It's June 13th, 2021. This is part 16 of a Grand Canyon oral history interview with Jim Haggart, last name spelled H-A-G-G-A-R-T. My name is Tom Martin. Good afternoon, Jim. How are you today?
We're doing great, Tom. I like to think you're doing as well.
Good. I'm glad to hear you're doing well. Yes, doing fine here. And Jim, may we have your permission to record this oral history over the telephone?
Yes, of course.
Super. Thank you. Last time you talked about a March 2001 hike out to the Pete's Terrace on the north side of the river. And can you pick that thread up? I think we're moving into 2002.
Yeah, that's right. So that was an attempt by Art and I to try and get around Powell Plateau at the Esplanade level. So it was our second major attempt to do that hike, and we had to turn back because of lack of water. So then in 2002, we did have a big hike planned into the Nanquip area in the spring. But before that took place, I was able to do a shorter trip with my new wife, Renee, into the Bass Camp area and Grand Scenic Divide area on the Esplanade. So that was in the middle part of March.
Hey, Jim.
And
I'm going to interrupt here. I've heard the term Grand Scenic Divide. Can you tell us what that means?
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, you're familiar with the early history of the canyon and the recreational aspects there, tourism aspects, and William Wallace Bass had a major facility out at the head of what was called his trail down the canyon, the South Bass Trail we call it today, and Bass took a lot of tourists down to the river there, or many of them just stayed up on the rim too and visited there. So he had developed kind of the area for its scenic exploitation possibilities, and one of the places that he would take people to is what's called Grand Scenic Divide. So if you take his trail from the rim down through the Kaibab, Torweep, and Coconino to the Esplanade level, then you can turn right and go to the northeast. And there would have been a trail out there now, but it's kind of, there's nothing left of it now. It's maybe a hiker's walk. And it's basically a big flat-topped mesa. Well, it's not a mesa. It's not disconnected from the rim, but it's just a flat-topped feature that extends out into the canyon, and it forms kind of like it's right where the river starts to turn from its northwest course through the central part of Grand Canyon to its more westerly course. And so if you're standing on the divide and you look to your right, you can look, a long distance all the way to Desert View, essentially, down the length of the canyon.
Okay.
And then if you turn 180 degrees and look to the west, you see the river entering a totally different area, essentially the beginning of this Esplanade Terraces area. And so it's totally different geomorphologic regimes in the Grand Canyon. And I've always assumed that's why they called it the Grand Scenic Divide, because it was just, it's a transition point between this tremendous view to the east down the traditional corridor of the Grand Canyon, and then this other view that a lot fewer people see because they don't get out in that part of the country that much, of Esplanade-dominated geology. So yeah, it's a pretty neat place, and we know that Bass took tourists down there quite a bit. There's a pillar, a summit, a block of Supai sandstone that sits out at the end of this ridge, and in the old books like George Warden James, In and Around the Grand Canyon, which was 1902, I think, or maybe 1901, he talks about this as one of the places that Bass would bring tourists, and they called it Dick's Pillar, after, I believe, it was one of Bass's assistants. So, it was a very, very popular area, and the whole area there around Mount Waithawali was visited quite a bit by the tourists under Bass's guidance.
Okay.
So, Grand Scenic Divide, yeah.
Yeah.
And So Renee and I went down the Bass Trail one afternoon and decided to camp there, right pretty much at the Grand Scenic Divide, where it, you know, is close to the rim. Not, we didn't go out way out onto the divide. I mean, you can basically walk out about a mile and a half, and it's all flat and nice. You know, it's a nice terrace, and like I say, has tremendous views. So we camped there, and then the next morning, we decided to do a traverse of Huxley and Spencer terraces. Now, these are to the two terraces to the north of Mount Waitholali. And Art and I had gone out Spencer a couple of years before when we went to Fisk Butte. So there's, if you walk out Spencer, you can find a notch in the Esplanade Sandstone right at the end of the terrace. And you can work your way down that notch and, you know, by chimneys and whatnot, and eventually get through all the Supai and down to the Red Wall and get to Fisk Butte. But Renee and I weren't interested in going for summits on this trip. Well, I should say we did do Fossil Mountain, but so we did get one. And but we did walk out onto Spencer Terrace and Huxley Terrace, and it was a fortuitous day for us because, as I mentioned, Art and I had gone through there in 2000, I believe it was, on our way to Fisk Butte. And we were kind of moving fast because we wanted to cover the ground. And we didn't pay too much attention to where we were walking by. And we went and we found the notch, the descent notch through the Supai. And that was, of course, our first primary objective. And we were very happy to have found that. So we didn't pay much attention to what was on the ground at our feet when we went out there. And so when Renee and I went there, we were walking out to the end of one of the terraces there, and we found this inscription on the sandstone that says Monte Video. And we had heard about this, but I'd never seen it, and Art and I had missed it when we had walked through there 2 years before. So it was really pretty cool, and it's a very neat, prominent inscription, and very distinctively carved in the stone. Nobody, I guess, really knows what the origin of the inscription means. I guess in Spanish it would be loosely translated as something like the mountains I can see from this place, or something like that, and which is very fitting. Because when one sits here, stands here, you can look across the canyon to the North Rim, and you see a tremendous array of mountains. If you know, in any other place, they'd be mountains. They're huge buttes and mesas that rise up above the surrounding landscape, and so it is mountains that one sees from that spot, and they're arrayed in 180. Well, maybe 270 degrees of your vision. So it's a pretty spectacular place. And, you know, we just kind of sat there and took in the views. This was a very relaxed trip for the two of us. So we were just taking it easy and kind of, you know, trying to figure out what this might have been all about. So, and then on the way back, we stopped off and spent a little bit of time at the site of the Mystic Spring, where Bass used to take his tourists. He had a camp down there, and sometimes they would stay overnight at Mystic Spring. It's dry now. Haven't seen water there any of the times I've ever visited. So, in fact, really not much evidence. There's some evidence that people have visited there, like some horse debris and things like that. But when I say horse debris, I mean like, you know, leather wear and things like that, reins and halters. But no water, unfortunately. And I was looking at a picture, actually, in an article about Montevideo, and there was a picture of some Maine lumberjacks who were visiting the area. So picture, if you will, lumberjacks from the state of Maine. Uh-huh. Going to the Grand Canyon on a holiday and going down to Bass's camp at Mystic Spring. And it's a very interesting picture because it's got a big pinyon pine in it. And I don't recall seeing that big pinyon when I was down there. But, of course, I'm sure it's it's still there. It'd be a neat trip to just to go down and try and recreate that precise photograph.
Yeah.
I don't think it'd be that difficult because it's a fairly small area. So, anyways, the main lumberjacks had been in there ahead of us. So we came back and camped again.
Hey Jim, I'm gonna jump in here and ask you about this Monte Video inscription.
Oh yeah.
The school of thoughts. There are two of them, and one is, well, this is a tourist from the Bass era of the late 1800s, early 1900s, that simply had some time and a hammer and a chisel and carved this in here. There's another school of thought that says this is from the 1540 Coronado expedition of conquistadores. Do you have any thoughts on this one way or another?
I guess I do. I mean, I have some feelings on it. I will preface this or by saying that I have not really done any thorough researching on this at all, but I have read a couple of articles and I kind of have thrown my thinking behind one of them because it seems to explain the most information. And yes, you're right. The two proposals have been generated, and the earliest proposal was that yes, it was the tourist from Bass that somebody was inspired to sit down and chisel out this saying on the rock. And then it was more recently in, I think, the 1970s when people from the parks or other researchers started to come up with the idea that it might have been one of the early Spanish conquistadors that had visited the canyon. Now, my understanding is that the Coronado expedition was focused more to the south in Arizona, and Coronado sent up a party of about a dozen people under Cardenas to the Grand Canyon area looking for this river. And they found the banks. They came, according to the translations of the old Spanish texts that documented this expedition, the team reached the banks, what they called the banks of the river. Now, this has been interpreted to be the canyon rim as opposed to the actual banks down at water level. And there's various reasons that they've assumed that. But they also figured that it was somewhere in the area from Desert View to about Bass because the early account had referred to kind of gnarly pines on the plateau, right? So to the east of Desert View, of course, there's no pinyon or juniper, and of course, once you go to the west of Great Thumb Mesa, you lose the pinyon and juniper. So it's got to be in that area that we call the traditional part of the Grand Canyon, where they came across the canyon. And according to the accounts of that expedition, which I guess were written down about 20 years after the conquistadors had actually gone into that area, they only had a few days on the rim, and the idea was they wanted to find a way down to the river. And so there was a party of three that was charged with trying to find a way to go down to the river, and they described how they could see the river below, and so they were trying to find a way down. The interesting thing is that from the Bass Camp area, you cannot see the river. And, I mean, if you go to certain places like to Havasupai Point, for instance, mm-hmm. you can see the river. But anywhere in the vicinity of Mount Waithawali, if you're down on the Esplanade, you can't really see the river. If you go to these terraces and go out to their ends, you can sometimes get a glimpse of the river, but right. nothing really substantial, you know? And so it kind of suggests that this early Spanish party probably encountered the rim farther or somewhere else than in the Bass area. That's the kind of the consensus thinking. And there's a really nice article in, it's called Park Science, put out by the National Park Service. Mm-hmm. By a fellow named Jonathan Upchurch, and he kind of takes this apart, this whole proposal, and talks about it and brings some evidence to bear on it. And one of the things he did was he looked at photographs of the inscription dating from like 1975 to 2011, I think it was, and he had about five different photographs, and he was able to see that there was changes in the geometry and the orientation of the letters. In other words, they had been weathering a bit,
mm-hmm.
and pieces of sandstone where they had been, you know, had the letters had been inscribed, had actually been eroded away in that 35-year period. So his thinking was, his suggestion was that if we see this much erosion in 35 years, how much would we expect to see, you know, in 500 years or mm-hmm. 450 years from when Coronado's expeditionary group under Cardenas had visited the canyon in around 1540. So, you know, that bit of evidence plus the fact that all these tourists were visiting, thousands of tourists visited the Bass Camp area when he had his tourism facilities established there. And, you know, the tourists would have had more time than these three Spanish fellows who were charged with trying to find a way down to the river in one day, right? And obviously that putting that inscription into the rock would take a fair amount of work. And if your job was to get down to the river, find a way down to the river for the boss, and come back with a report of a successful conclusion, you probably wouldn't have spent 4 hours, 8 hours, whoever, who knows how long it would take to make that beautiful inscription,
mm-hmm.
You know, while trying to while away the time. So you know, on the basis of all that evidence, it does seem kind of unrealistic that the Spanish explorers would have been the creators of that inscription. But still, it's a very romantic idea to think about, and I don't think we'll ever know definitively one way or the other. And it like I say, it makes a nice story. And again, those accounts, you know, of those Spanish explorations were written, in some cases, decades after they actually took place.
Right.
They were, it's kind of like books in the Bible, you know. They were written by people who didn't live through the times necessarily, but just repeated the stories that they had been told. So we don't know definitively what the report of that expedition's history was, and we can only just the historians can only make interpretations, right, based
yeah.
on
yeah.
the best available data. So I mean, you know, you always hear about ancient texts being found in old libraries in Europe and other places around the world, and it's possible that there's some hidden Spanish documents that will come to light that might throw more detail on this whole theory, you know, the whole time when the Coronado expedition was exploring in Arizona and their attempt to locate the Colorado River. They certainly located the river. It's just they probably didn't get down to it.
Right. No, I hope I didn't spend too much time on that. With the Maine lumberjacks, maybe they did it.
They did it. That's right.
Yeah.
That's a good one, Tom. They took their big double bladed axes.
And they were good at carving sandstone. Who knows? Okay, so you're down there with Renee, and you checked out the inscription, and then what'd you do?
Yeah. So then we camped again at our same spot there, and I remember we were having problems with crows, and it was springtime, and we had some jelly beans, and I remember that was they're very tempting, I guess, for the crows, you know, those colored things, because we were very relaxed in our camping. We just had our stuff spread out on our ground cloth, you know, and open to the air. So, but we managed to deal with that, and then the next morning we did our walk out Grand Scenic Divide and as far as we could go easily, and came back, and then we went back up to the rim. And before we left the area, we did a nice walk out to the rim towards Havasupai Point. So there's basically jeep roads that go out there,
mm-hmm.
and just a nice walk through the forest. There's an old signal tower, fire tower, up there on the point, south of the point. And then we walked over to the Havasupai Point, which is close to looking down on Grand Scenic Divide from the rim, but a little bit to the east. And then Renee said, well, why don't we go try and climb Fossil Mountain, because she likes to see fossils, and it's my job, actually, is paleontology, so I like to see fossils. And so we did. We walked over to Fossil Mountain, and she got her first and only Grand Canyon summit. So
cool.
Unless you count Comanche Point, but that's a rim feature, so it's not really that high on the list. But, yeah, Fossil Mountain was a fun little jaunt up there, and there are tremendous numbers of these big productive brachiopods that you find in the Kaibab limestone all over that area.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm sure that was a big draw for the bass tourists, too, to see all these fossils. I don't know why in particular that area is so plentiful, but maybe just because the Kaibab is so easily accessed. You know, it's easy to walk around through the Kaibab in that area
mm-hmm.
because it's all weathered to gentle slopes. But,
Yeah,
so that was the end of that trip, and
okay.
a great little trip. Like I say, Renee got her first summit, and we actually got to see the Montevideo inscription that Art and I had missed on our previous walk through there a couple years earlier. So that was a kind of a highlight for sure. And I also pointed out, I think, last week that all the few hikes that Renee and I had done together in the Grand Canyon had all been challenged by weather. And so this one was deluxe because the weather was perfect. You
know, nice.
One of those great canyon experiences, calm weather and cool and perfect. So nice trip.
Nice.
And then so shortly after that, Art and Bruce and I were planning a long trip into Nankweep. And this was planned to be a really big trip. So Renee and I did our hike in mid-March, and then in the first part of April is when Art and Bruce Grubbs and I decided to try this, undertake this trip from Saddle Mountain, and we were going to hike all the way through the Eastern Canyon, following the high route, which goes up from Nankweep and over through the Red Wall into Upper Quaggan, and then you climb up through the Red Wall again, and you get into Upper Lava. So the high route is what's colloquially referred to as the western route that you can do through the eastern part of Grand Canyon, as opposed to the Horse Thief Butte Fault route, which is farther to the east at lower elevation. And the high route requires fairly high climbs to get up some of the saddles in the Red Wall or even the Supai to get across into the various drainages. So
mm-hmm.
so we were going to – our plan was to do that route all the way around to Clear Creek and then go up up the Red Wall in Clear Creek to Diva Point, Diva Temple, and then hike out to the plateau via Obi Point and then walk the plateau all the way back to Point Imperial and then go down to Saddle Mountain. So it was a big, ambitious trip.
Yeah.
And the idea was we were going to be able to get a bunch of summits on the way because, you know, taking the high route brings you right past so many different summits that you have plenty of opportunity to drop your backpack and go bag another one. So it was a pretty ambitious plan. And we started this trip. Again, I flew down. So Renee and I had gone back to Vancouver, and then I came back down a couple weeks later.
Okay.
And I flew down, and Art picked me up, and we drove to Flagstaff and stayed in Bruce and Dewart's house. Dewart Martin is Bruce's partner.
Okay.
They've lived up there in Flagstaff for many, many years, and they've always been very generous in letting us crash in their place before or after hikes. And we got up in the morning, and I was feeling – it was like I had the worst sleep ever when I was in Flagstaff this this trip. I have no idea what it was, because usually with the cool air of Flagstaff, I'm always just out like a light, but I had a really bad time with that. And so I was pretty groggy on the drive up to House Rock Valley and then down to Saddle Canyon. So yeah, it was kind of a slow start to the trip. And we got going, and interestingly, we parked the car at Saddle Canyon. So we had the three of us, and Bruce is at this time, I think he had an Impreza, a Subaru Impreza, and we parked his car at the trailhead there, and there were a couple of guys in cowboy boots and Levi's with fishing gear.
Whoa.
And they wanted to know how to get down to the river to go fishing. So kind of paradoxical. They were obviously, in the wrong area. And we explained to them, well, if you, to get down to the river from here, you know, it's quite a long trek down the Nanquib Trail. Didn't want to suggest to them that they could go one of the cross-country routes, you know, from the rim down to the river.
Right.
Or more likely, they probably were trying to get to, like, South Canyon or someplace like that,
right,
where there's hiker's access and you can get down to the river more readily. So so Art gave them instructions on how to get back to where they should be heading. And I think they were kind of bewildered, you know, at the scale of the country that they were in, and trying to find a route down to the river to go fishing. So it was a good chuckle for us. Actually, interestingly, come to think of it here, you know, they were vastly unprepared for the adventure that awaited them. And I won't say we were vastly unprepared for the adventure that awaited us, but we certainly had bid off quite a big package here, as I'll tell you about over the next couple of days. So anyways, we packed, you know, put our packs on and hiked up the the Saddle Mountain Trail up to the saddle, and then just had a fairly relaxing, but we had heavy packs because we were planning to go for 8 or 9 days.
Okay.
We had a lot of food there.
Yeah.
And I remember running into a party of like 8 people camped on top of the Red Wall, and that's a very popular spot to camp. I've never seen anybody other than this one time camp there, and I camped there once myself. But this was a big party, like 8 people. They may have been Sierra Club or something like that. Hmm. They were on their way out, and they had decided to come up from the river halfway to the top of the Red Wall before going out the next day back to their car. Anyways, we continued down the trail, and we actually decided to go down. If you go down the Red Wall, and you can follow along the Red Wall rim there, you go down through the Tapiz, and it's a straight shot down to the creek, but we decided to go cut across the terraces there to the west and avoid the area around the campground. So we had a really nice campsite up in Upper Nanquib, well, about 2 miles above the where the trail comes down to the creek there.
Oh, nice.
And the whole valley is full of cottonwoods, and it's very open, and I shouldn't say full of cottonwoods. They're here and there, of course, but it's very open and very spacious, good views, and so we had a great campsite there in preparation for the next couple of days, because from this point on, we were going to be doing a lot of uphill, right,
mm-hmm.
and downhill, uphill and downhill. It was going to be challenging, but we felt confident, you know, we were in pretty good shape.
Mm-hmm.
Although I'd had some problems with like sleep that I mentioned, so it was a little awkward. Anyways, the next morning we got up and we headed up. The idea was to go up to the drainage between Swilling and Dupa, so where Hutton Butte is. There's a drainage, an arm of Nanquib that goes up directly to the south, and you go up high enough, and Hutton Butte sits right there in the saddle, and there's smaller buttes, Dupa and Swilling, to either side of Hutton, and from there you can actually go down to the south, continue to the south down into Tequagan. But we wanted to get some summits, right? So we found a pretty nice route up through the Tapetes and the 60-mile formations, and then into the little valley there of Red Wall Valley that is on the north side of Hutton Butte. It's really a pretty little spot. There's I've been in there a number of times, and it's very gentle gradient, and there's no water in there, which is unfortunate, but just a very pleasant place to walk, which was good because we had heavy packs, and when we got up to the Hutton Butte saddle there, we dropped the packs, and Art and I decided to go climb up Dupa, which is just a third-class Red Wall Butte to the east, and then following that, we went and climbed up Swilling, which is a stiff third-class Red Wall Butte to the west of the saddle, and Bruce decided he wanted to work with his radio. I mentioned before that he loves to carry little tiny ham radios, and I think in the ham world, I understand there's it's not necessarily a contest, but it's kind of a badge of honor as to how small a transmitting radio you can construct and still make contact with people in various places around the world.
Oh,
so,
yeah, neat.
You know, Bruce he's a master engineer, and not formally, but he just thinks that way. And so he has designed these radios, which are incredibly compact and minute.
Huh.
And then he can sit there with, Morse code and make connections with people, around the world. And it's just kind of amazing that, he can set up this antenna and then correspond with people in, who knows, Latvia or Philippines or whatever. And so he likes to spend his time doing that while Art and I head off on the summits. So you might make the connection that Bruce is probably the smarter of the three of us, right? He knows how to relax.
Mm-hmm.
So anyways, we got our two summits in, and then headed down south from Hutton there. It's a steep climb, a steep drop down. And I've done it a number of times since, and hopefully I'll do it again. But it is a steep drop, and so especially with heavy packs. But you have to be very careful. And eventually you get down to the Tapetes Rim, and you have to wander around looking for the right breaks through the cliff. But they're there. And so eventually we got down to the bed of the creek. It was getting pretty late in the afternoon. So we walked upstream a little ways because we were going to be heading up the next day up through the Red Wall that in the arm that goes up west of Banta Point. So between Banta Point and Atoko Point, or between Siegfried Pyre and Atoko Point. So that was our going to be our hike direction the next day. But we were hoping to find some water.
So Art and I,
after we dropped the packs, walked upstream about, I don't know, three-quarters of a mile into the Tapetes Narrows, and we couldn't find any water, which was kind of, disappointing. But we had some water to get us over into Quaggan if we needed it. But we did decide, though, that the next day we would go downstream and get more water in Quaggan. So if you go down a couple of miles down Quaggan, there's a good flow down there, and we knew we could get a good supply there, and then be well positioned to head up to the south.
So you're in the upper Quaggan drainage, is that right?
Yeah. Well, at this point, we have dropped into Quaggan, and this would be, I guess, about 3 miles short of the back end of the drainage.
Okay.
So it's pretty far up.
Okay.
And like I say, it's, if you come up from the river, you have a good flow in Quaggan up until about a mile and a half, 2 miles above the Butte Fault.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's, that's where the water comes up in springs.
Right.
And above that, it's normally dry.
Right.
So I've never seen water flowing in Quaggan above those springs. But fortunately, as I found out the next morning, before we actually got our day packs out with our water bottles in them, empty water bottles, and started to run downstream to the known water. I went up this drainage that we were going to have to go up and into the Tapeets, and I found this beautiful pothole in the basal part of the Tapeets. You had to climb up a little wall and just a friction climb up this little ledge, sloping wall, I guess, and then you could look over into this beautiful pothole.
Wow.
Filled with water, probably 3 feet deep, something like
wow.
that. So we were set. We were set. And, you know, I've been back there a number of times since, probably 3 or 4 times since, and water has always been in that pothole. So it's pretty reliable, which
nice.
It's great because you know that you got water in that upper part of Quaggan, you know. So the next morning, that's the morning I found the water, is the morning of, I think it was April 6th or something. And Bruce decided that he'd kind of had enough of this trip. And, he wanted to be more relaxed and take his time doing the walking. And, you know, he wasn't particularly interested in the summits. So he decided that he would split from us and hike down Quaggan and then work his way back, you know, to the vehicle on his own time. And, you know, Art and I said, well, that's fine. We're going to continue on, and we're still within striking distance here of our schedule, so
mm-hmm.
let's continue on and see how things go. And we said goodbye to each other in the morning, and then we started up. And it's a stiff climb to go up through. First, you go through the Peets, and right at the mouth of the canyon, side canyon, and then you scramble up through the Bright Angel Shale, and in actuality, in the shale, there are little seeps and flows
oh.
of water that, have been there several times. Now that you know where they are, it's relatively nice. Well, they actually supply this pothole, so that's the pothole's very easy to get to for people who are going to be hiking in that area. It's just about eight minute walk, I guess, up the this canyon, this side canyon, and then you scramble up the first cliff of Tapeets, and there it is. So, but there's a flow up above in the shale, and then you get into the red wall, and I had come down the red wall many years prior, and that trip when I came down to meet Doug Rickard at the river.
Oh, uh-huh.
And I did that trip very, very fast with a very light pack and late in the day. And I remember getting, I think we talked about this, a couple places I got kind of in a desperate situation because I didn't think I could climb back up where I had come down.
Right.
And it didn't look like I could really continue going the way I was. But it did work out in the end. So we were, this trip, Art and I were going up that red wall descent route and coming at it from the bottom. And quite honestly, it was challenging, but it wasn't nearly as difficult as I expected. So, you know, when you're coming from the bottom, you have a much better view of what the objectives are, where the challenges are. And so we pieced it together. I mean, I'm not saying it was easy, but it was, it was straightforward.
Yeah.
Nothing to really sweat about, but sweating indeed I was because it was extremely challenging physically, and I don't know what it was, Tom, but something was off with my health on that trip, you know, because I just did not have the capacity for the uphill slog that I usually do. And I remember going up, so once you get above the red wall, then you have to continue up the steep gullies in the Supai with cliffs that you got to climb around or through, and it just doesn't let up, and it's in places, you know, you're just digging your toes into the shale slopes and hanging on with your hands onto bushes and stuff and stepping up 1 foot at a time. It was, and of course, trying to pull your pack through the brush and everything. It was really challenging and frustrating, and I was having to take like stops after every step up. It was
wow.
just really frustrating. And so we got to the top of that that climb, and you have to go all the way up to the top of the Supai too, so it's a big climb. And I particularly was just exhausted, and I remember we sat there and rested in the shade of a Coconino Butte for a good bit of time to try and recover our strength. And me in particular, I don't think Art was as badly affected as I was. So, anyways, it was kind of sobering because it took us longer than we expected. It was basically noonish by the time we got up there, and we were kind of expecting to be into Lava Creek by that time. So we knew we were moving slowly. So it certainly was something to think about as we continued south. So we, in fact, we had planned to climb Siegfried Pyre, which is a big butte off of Atoko Point in the Eastern Canyon. It's very massive, and we had planned to do that, and we actually just walked right by it because the two of us were, we figured it was more important to capitalize on the time we had left and our remaining strength to get to a reasonable campsite, right? So we've continued down south, and so you're working your way as you're going south now into the upper arm of Lava Canyon, Lava Creek. You're working your way down through the Supai gradually, one ledge at a time. So you find a break and you go down through that, and then you walk horizontally for a while until the next break, and then you work your way down that, et cetera. And you slowly descend down through the Supai then, and you eventually get onto this long ridge that goes south from Siegfried Pyre, and it's basically a long red wall ridge that curves around, makes like a big S curve. So along this red wall ridge, there's several buttes. And the next one down from Siegfried to the south was Hubble Butte. And we dropped our packs right at the base of Hubble on the red wall rim. And we figured, okay, we'll camp here, but we'll go give Hubble a try because we'd read in Harvey's notes that it was a pretty straightforward climb. So we walked up the Supai slope to the summit block of Hubble and walked around it and found what was the obvious ascent crack. And quite honestly, I just did not have the energy to actually launch into that crack. So we basically, turned tail and walk back down to our camp. So, yeah, it was a frustration. And I haven't done this peak since, right? I haven't been exactly back
Oh,
in
interesting.
that part of the canyon. So it's one of the few in the entire Eastern Canyon that I haven't climbed, and yet it's a very easy one. So, anyways, we knew we couldn't do it, and at that time, anyways. So we came back down to our camp on the Red Wall Rim and relaxed, and then had an enjoyable evening there. So we had enough water at this point, to carry us overnight without any water source, and because of what we'd found in the pothole in the upper arm of Quaggan. So it was a, I remember it being a pleasant night and getting a good sleep. I maybe because we were lower, or maybe just because I was so physically exhausted. But from that point on, I think the trip was like a changing point because Art and I decided. Definitely was a changing point, but Art and I decided we were too far behind now to accomplish our original goal, which was to go all the way over to Clear Creek and then up on the plateau at Obi Point and then hike back to our car across the plateau. We probably could have done it if we had just focused on motoring through one way with no side trips or anything like that, but that's not the way we like to hike. So we decided at that point that that this more or less as far south as we would go would be Lava Creek and Char Creek Valley. And then at that point, we would head north. So in the morning, we got up and started south, walking along this Red Wall Ridge. And there's several buttes on this ridge that I don't even know why they are called summits, but why they have names, but they're little pimples of rock. Poston Butte and Chiavria Point is a big buttress of red wall. Obviously, that looks impressive from below, and that's why presumably all these little peaks like Hubble and Poston were named as independent summits because they look impressive from below. But Poston, we actually walked across with our full backpacks on. So I think that's the only summit I've ever done in the Grand Canyon where I actually hiked across it with a full backpack on. Usually you're scrambling up or you know, climbing up with ropes and with very limited gear. But that's just the nature of that particular summit. And this was supposed to be also an old miner's route by which he would bring his mules into the canyon, a guy named Harry McDonald. So Butcher talked about this in his Grand Canyon Treks books. And we were quite interested in trying to figure out, you know, just where McDonald would have built his trail through this area. It's very, very challenging country to build a trail.
Yeah.
And we saw no vestiges of trail. So it was, kind of paradoxical. But supposedly, because McDonald had been seen down in the Char Creek Valley with his mule team, and he also had been seen on the North Rim. This would have been in the early 1900s, by the way. You know, the assumption was made that he had some sort of a trail access to get to his claims down in the eastern Grand Canyon. But I don't think that's ever been corroborated, and certainly we saw no evidence of any sort of trail construction in there. Mind you, that I mean, you could get a mule through there. There's no question about that. But it would be a lot of work. So, that story, I think, is still under investigation. So we continue down this Redwall Ridge, and then we climb Chiavria Point, which is just a bump on the ridge, and then worked our way down through the Redwall Break below that. And you have to traverse quite a distance along the rim of the Tapetes to finally get down into the bed of Lava Creek. But once you get there, it's a fascinating area, and I'm sure you've hiked up there from the river with your river parties. But there's a beautiful ruin right at the junction of Lava and Natchez Canyon. So Natchez Canyon is just an arm of lava that goes to the west and heads right up underneath the plateau, and then the arm of lava that continues to the north actually goes up to the Hartman Bridge too, the natural bridge that is found in upper Lava Canyon, which I'm sure the river runners go to and check out. So, you know, we were in fairly visited country at this point, and this ruin is pretty impressive in this place under a ledge of Tapete sandstone. So we spent a little bit of time there, and then decided to just go down Char Creek down to the river.
Okay.
And so this was as far south as we got then on this grand circuit was Char Creek Valley. And fortunately, the walking down Char Creek is very straightforward. It's all, you know, more or less just gently sloping creek. And it's a very open, there's not much vegetation.
Yeah.
So there's water here and there once you get down closer to the towards the river. And you know, it's all very peaceful and relaxing hiking. So, you know, we were having a great time, and we knew that we'd made the right decision to break off on the hike. So, and we knew that, of course, our car was still going to be in the same place, right? So it didn't matter because we had planned to do a big loop. We were just doing a different loop, but still going to be ending at the same, starting and ending at the same spot.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. So we continued down Char and found a nice campsite right there where the Butte Fault cuts across. Typically, you get water in all these drainages where the Butte Fault cuts across.
Yep.
And you're a short distance above the river there too. So. So we had a nice campsite there, and in the morning, I got up, and we both got up, and Art relaxed while I ran up Lava Butte, and which was a lot of fun, a very interesting route, I remember. So these are the Precambrian lavas, right, that were described by Walcott in the late 1880s.
Right.
And they're capped by the Tapete sandstone, so it's part of the great unconformity there where the Cambrian sits on top of the late Precambrian. and this is the sedimentary and volcanic package, which postdates the Vishnu schist, but is still beneath the Cambrian rocks, and it's fairly widely distributed in parts of eastern Grand Canyon, and so it was very neat climbing in the sense that there was all this volcanic rock there, which you don't normally get in the Grand Canyon, right? I mean, downstream and lava. In the vicinity of lava falls and Tuweap, you have volcanic flows down there, and there are places where recent basalt flows are kind of plastered up on the sides of the western Grand Canyon.
That's right.
But this is a fairly thick succession of basalt volcanic rocks that is very widespread in the eastern part of Grand Canyon, in certain areas, very thick succession of volcanic rocks. So I climbed up to the top of Lava Butte and got another summit there, and then we went down to the river to relax in the water at the river there, because it's kind of warm down there at this time of year. And so later that morning, actually, we went and started and hiked the River Runner Trail over to Carbon Creek. And I have to say, I mean, this is the first time I'd ever been on this River Runner's Trail. And it was like a highway, you know. I guess what happens is the river runners stop at either Carbon or Lava and then do a loop, you know, up Lava, across the divide to Carbon Creek, and then down Carbon Creek back to the river, right? So it was a beautiful trail through there. It was very easy to walk. And just before we got to Carbon, we dropped our packs again. And I went up Char Lava Hill, which is another one of these volcanic successions.
Mm-hmm.
And I've just been reading some interesting field geology reports by Charles Walcott about his work in this part of Grand Canyon in the 1880s. And based on his field notes, we know that he actually did the first recorded ascent of Char Lava Hill as well as Nankoweap Butte in the Nankoweap Valley Basin. So he was describing the volcanic rocks that comprise this late Precambrian succession.
Right.
And to describe these volcanic rocks, he walked up through them at the biggest pile that he could find, which was Char Lava Hill, and described the different, you know, phases of the volcanic rocks that he encountered as he went from the oldest rocks in the succession to the youngest rocks at the top of the peak. So, and then he described how, you know, the rocks had certain characteristics at the top of the peak. So we know that, you know, based on his field notes, that Walcott made the first recorded ascents of both of these summits. And of course, as we mentioned in the past, Aboriginals were all over this country.
Right.
And, before modern hikers and geologists and explorers came into the picture. So, you know, it's not, obviously other peoples have been there for thousands of years ahead of us, but I think it's pretty neat that a geologist made the first recorded ascent of these particular buttes. And I think it's pretty neat too that we know that because he left really good detailed notes in his field studies. So
nice.
That's a little aside there. Coming from a geologist, right? My entire career is recorded in about 75 field notebooks that I have in my office. So.
Nice. Yeah.
Yeah.
Cool.
So at that point, we were in Carbon Creek, and we knew we had a fairly straightforward hike back to our car, right? You can just follow the Butte Fault for many, many miles, and to the north. You go up, you go down, you go up, you go down. And so we camped in Carbon, and then the next day we did split up as we went up Char Creek. Art went up the main fork, which is, I guess, the east fork that goes right up under Temple Butte.
Right.
And this is where Bruce Grubbs and I had gone in 78 when we climbed Temple Butte. So Art went up that way, but I went up the next arm to the west.
Okay.
And the reason I did that was because I came up around the west side of Carbon Butte,
mm-hmm.
and then was able to scramble over to that summit.
Okay.
So Carbon Butte's just a big slump block of red wall limestone that has slid down a little bit, but you know, it has some relief, and and it's named, so you got to climb it, right? And from that point, then, so Art and I are moving parallel, right?
Right.
And he's down in the valley of the East Fork, and I'm kind of up on the ridge where Carbon Butte is, and I continued up that ridge and got through the to Pete's and in two places to kind of come back down and meet him in the saddle between 60 Mile and Carbon Creek.
Okay.
And he'd been waiting there, I guess, for a good hour or so before I got there, because he hadn't had to go as high, and he didn't do any climbs on the way. So at that point, then it was pretty late in the day, and we started down heading for 60 Mile, and it was getting pretty dark. We were actually using our headlamps to basically navigate, and we found a little tiny, I remember finding just enough space to put down a ground sheet for two you know, sleeping pads and, and sleeping bags right in the bed of that creek. And so, yeah, we laid down there and knocked off for the night. And then, the next day, again, we continued north along the Butte Fault. And I have to say it was kind of uneventful, right? It's just kind of continuous hiking, up and down these, the passes.
Right.
And, eventually we got over to Nankweep, and then, on our penultimate day. And then in the morning of the last day, we got up really early, 4:30 I think it was, to get up the Nankweep as fast as we could before the sun came out on us. So we're heading up the Nankweep, and I just was refreshing my notes here, and I said I read in my notes that I said that I said it looked like there was a route through pretty much all of the Red Wall in the arm that's east of Marion Point. Now, I've actually been through there many times and looked at that, but this particular time I got the idea that it looked like there was a route there. And then similarly, I made a notation in my notes that it looks like there's a route out of Little Nankweep to the rim, east of Saddle Mountain, that goes up through the Supai, well, all the way to the Kaibab.
That's right.
So two things to check out sometime the next time I'm back in that area, and a good reason to reread your old notes, right?
Yeah, yeah. No,
so the only thing that was the last more or less eventful thing of this trip was we got up to the saddle of Saddle Mount of the Saddle Mountain Trail, Nankweep Trail, and Art kind of relaxed there while I ran up to Saddle Mountain, and there's just been a burn in there. I think the year before, 2001.
Okay.
Not sure exactly when that was, but a large part of that valley, that Saddle Mountain, beautiful valley there with all those ponderosas, had burned.
Yes.
And including the northwest side of Saddle Mountain itself. So, I mean, it was actually kind of beneficial in a way because I had no brush to contend with, right? It was just a straight shot up the slopes there, and to get to the summit. And you know, you have tremendous views up there, and there's a huge cairn, presumably built by the Powell Party when they were in that area surveying, and they built the Nankweep Trail, too, that the summer that, or the winter, I should say, that Walcott did his work. And so, you know, it's a pretty historical place to check out.
Yeah.
And it was my eighth summit of the trip, so that was pretty cool.
Nice.
Right? I got eight summits on that trip. And in spite of the fact that it had kind of not gone the way we anticipated. So one little footnote to the story, and this is that, remember I told you that Bruce had split up from us after about day three, I think
right.
It was. And so his plan was to kind of take a relaxed trip back, you know, through the Eastern Canyon and then go back up and meet us. Or go back to Flagstaff, but we only had Art's car there, right? So, of course, you know, there's always a spare key left at the car, and so Art described where that key was, and I guess Bruce actually made it back to the car pretty quick, like within 2 days from where we split up.
Okay.
So he actually took Art's car back to Flagstaff, and just to get cleaned up and you know, get back to civilization. Uh-huh. And then the next day, he came back with Art's car, and a friend of his, I don't know who it was, but a friend of his drove Bruce's car.
Okay.
And so the idea was that you know, he didn't have to wait for us for 3 or 4 days
right.
to finish our trip.
Right.
He could just do all this driving and then get back to Flagstaff and still leave Art's car at the trailhead. So, but I guess what happened was when they got into House Rock Valley somewhere, they had a flat in Bruce's car, and they had to go all the way to Fredonia to get it fixed. So it was kind of a long day on that shuttling for Bruce and his friend. But eventually, you know, they dropped Art's car off, and it was waiting for us when we arrived at the end of our hike. So,
cool.
Yeah, it was a – God, I feel like I've just talked incessantly here and describing this. And it was one of these big hikes where, you know, you have a lot planned, and you still do a lot even though you cut it short. And it's kind of the nature of hiking, I guess, in the canyon for myself and Art, you know, and Bruce. We're constantly having to we're constantly rejigging the plan.
Right. Right.
When it's deemed necessary, or when you want to. Right.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
And so in this particular case, we definitely made the right decision to cut it short, and we still had a great trip in the end. You know, this. Lots of historical encounters and 8 summits, which is pretty impressive for one hike.
Pretty good.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. So a really nice trip overall, for sure.
It sounds lovely. Yeah. Very nice.
Yeah, for sure.
All
in
right.
fact, it's one of the, there's so many great trips that they really kind of start to kind of blend together. But this, you know, when I go back and review my notes and look at photographs and then look at the map and realize where we hiked, it's quite satisfying and impressive, right? To realize what we chewed off there.
Yeah,
so.
Absolutely. It's some wonderful rugged terrain, and you know, you hear about people doing the Butte Fault, but you hear rarely about people that are making that same north-south journey, but further to the west.
It's a challenge, and I would still like to do it. I mean, I've never done it through all the way myself, and I would like to do it, but I just, you know, typically I want to get into these areas like Unkar Creek, and I've never actually spent any time in the Unkar Creek drainage. It's like one of the huge bullseyes on my map where I've never hiked. You know, I've been along the river down low, but never in the upper arms. So, you know, to go through that country without taking 3 to 4 days to stop and explore it all,
right.
I don't think I could do it.
it's big and beautiful country. So
yeah, and there's so much to see and do that, you know. Like I say, if you're at all interested in summiting, then doing this high route, you know, there's too many temptations, and you know, you're just gonna get waylaid.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, great. We've been talking for a little over an hour. Maybe this is a good place to put a comma in this oral history interview, and we'll pick it up next week.
Okay, that sounds great, Tom.
All right.
Well, appreciate the opportunity.
With that, this will conclude part 16. Grand Canyon Oral History Interview with Jim Haggart. Today is Sunday, June 13th, 2021. My name is Tom Martin. And Jim, thank you so very much.
Thank you, Tom. I really appreciate you giving me the opportunity to chat like this.
Ah, it's my pleasure. Hang on.